My name is Ari Lannis, and I am the Senior Multifaith Educator at Global Spiritual Life at NYU, and you are listening to Multifaithful, the podcast about religious diversity, multifaith dialogue, and effing the ineffable. On this week's podcast, I am joined by Professor Diana Eck from Harvard University and founder of the Pluralism Project at Harvard, which documents multifaith and interfaith cooperation across the country. We discuss the history and future of multifaith work, as well as her own interest as a Christian woman in Hinduism and different religious and spiritual identities. Thank you for tuning in to Multifaithful and out of this week's conversation. So I am joined today by Professor Diana Eck, who is a professor of comparative religion and Indian studies at Harvard University, and also the founder of the Pluralism Project, which documents religious diversity and instances of interfaith coordination around the country, according to many, including myself. I think Professor Eck is one of the most important figures in this work in the United States and maybe the world, so it's a really pleasure to have her today. And I'm joined today by one of our amazing students, Molly. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hello, my name is Molly Chakravarti, and I'm an undergraduate senior in the Silver School of Social Work in the College of Public Health, studying social work and global public health.
Great. And Molly is also a member of our Multifaith Advisory Council here and came actually on a trip with this office to Abu Dhabi last year, which was really fun, and she can tell you about that another time. So, Professor Eck, I am curious, and I know that I've actually read a lot of your work in religion classes I've taken, and just in out of interest. And you have kind of focused on two parts of the world, India and on the United States. And I'm curious how those two interests have bled into each other, and kind of how your interest in India led you to focus on the United States, and maybe vice versa.
That's a great question, and one that brings me into a little bit of my own history. I went to India as an undergraduate student on a year-long study abroad program, and just to shock you, that was 50 years ago this year. And so it was 1965, and I had come from the mountains of Montana. I didn't know a lot of people of other faiths. I went to college at Smith College and had quite a few Jewish friends, but basically I had grown up in a Protestant world, very social activist kind of Protestant world, but I was unfamiliar with a lot of the rest of the world, and we were at the same time, we, the United States, were very involved, really up to our knees, up to our waist in a part of the world about which very few people I knew very much about, and that was Southeast Asia, Vietnam. And so I kind of wanted to go somewhere for my junior year, and I couldn't find a program except this wonderful program that the University of Wisconsin has and it still has in India. So I went and spent a year living in the city of Benares, or Varanasi, on the Ganges in North India, with another group of students. There were 10 of us, and studying, doing our independent field study projects, learning Hindi, and basically, for me, that was a year-long encounter with people of other faiths, because there weren't that many Protestant Christians in Varanasi.
That's fair.
So all of my neighbors, all of my teachers were Hindus, were Muslims. It was the first city in which I ever heard the call to prayer. There was a very big Buddhist center outside Varanasi and Sarnath. There were Sikhs. So it was an extraordinary experience. And I think especially because of the predominance of Hinduism there, I developed a huge number of questions about who are Hindus? Why are there so many images of God? Why are they worshiping in these particular ways? And I could recognize, because of my own faith, I could recognize that these were people of faith. It was just a different faith from my own, and it became just an incredible opportunity to ask questions of them, but also of myself. And so that year really changed my life. And I will say, by way of a footnote here, that I've just come from the University of Wisconsin South Asia Conference that takes place in Madison every fall. It is the biggest sort of confluence of South Asianists anywhere in the world, really. And we had a reunion of the 50 years of us who had gone to India 50 years ago. And it's an incredible group of people, all of whom are motivated by global issues, some of whom went into diplomacy issues, some went into academic work, as I did, some went into social work and social action, some went into high school teaching. But it's an extraordinary group of people, and I think the experience of encounter is one that just dramatically changes your life. But let me add another footnote to that year. That was 1965. And while we were there, the new Immigration and Nationalities Act was signed into law at the base of the Statue of Liberty by Lyndon Johnson. And he said at that time that this new immigration law that opened the doors to immigration in the United States really for the first time in many, many decades, in over 100 years, really, that was not based on nationality or, frankly, that was not racist. And that this, he felt, would not necessarily change the U.S. that much. But he felt, as he put it, that this would right an enduring wrong in American immigration policy. And it did right an enduring wrong, but it also changed the texture and the weave of America dramatically. And that is the link, really, between India and America for me. And that is that, you know, the communities that I had become interested in and studied and become part of, in a way, in India, now became, over the next decades, they became American religious communities. The immigration that brought people from South Asia, from India, from Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, from East Asia, from Korea, and then, of course, from Southeast Asia, where we had a lot of, at first, refugee communities from Vietnam and Cambodia. These people became part of us and put down roots and came not only with their economic dreams and their wish for a free political atmosphere, but they also came with their religious traditions and have made the U.S. into what is really now a multi-religious nation in a more dramatic way than ever before. So that's the link. Mm-hmm. And that's what got me started working on the United States as well.
Great.
Awesome. Thank you. Just jumping on into a second question, can you speak a little bit about your pluralism project?
Yes. The pluralism project really began with this new reality. I've often said that if I'd been teaching kindergarten in New Jersey, I would have been awake to what was happening in my own country a lot sooner. But as a college teacher, it wasn't really until the late 1980s that the children of the new immigration came to college. And they did. And, you know, by the early 90s, both of the students who were elected first marshals to lead their class in commencement at Harvard were Hindus. And the baccalaureate service that took place before commencement included readings from the Vedas and Upanishads, from the Quran, from the Christian and Jewish scriptures.
Wow.
I mean, just an amazing thing. That began about 1990. Mm. And I realized that I didn't know enough about my own country. And all of these students were in college. They were in my classes. We used to talk in that language of the other. We needed to learn about mm-hmm. the other, and suddenly yeah. we were all other to one another. And so the Pluralism Project began really as seminars in which students and I would go out and explore the new religious landscape of Boston. And we'd go out in teams, and we'd go out as a class, and people would do individual projects. But Boston was just an amazing laboratory to see what was happening. And one thing led to another, and I did get some funding then first from the Lilly Endowment, to have students study other parts of the U.S. It became sort of hometown research, and they would spend the summer in Minneapolis or in Oklahoma City or in Houston or in the Bay Area. Mm. And this was not sort of sophisticated demographic research because we weren't kind of number cruncher people. I was glad when Pew came along and decided to do that. But these were people who were collecting kind of the micro histories of their own communities. And yeah. So that was sort of the genesis of it, really a curiosity about what was happening in our country. I had never really witnessed, for example, the Mahakumbha Abhisheka of a Hindu temple in India, but I did follow the one that happened in a Boston suburb in Ashland, and I hadn't really been to any American Islamic center until I started this research, or to the Sikh Gurdwaras that are here in Boston. And that became the sort of bridge of personal connection that both made academic life extremely challenging and interesting, but also that was enriching spiritually and civically, I would say, for my life as a Christian, but also for our lives as Americans.
So it's interesting you're coming back to this the story of immigration, because I know one of the things that you write about a lot, one of the things I talk to people a lot about, is how interfaith in the 1950s and 60s usually meant Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant, and how now it's so much more diverse and pluralistic than that. So I'm curious if, looking forward, are there certain demographic trends or certain trends that you're seeing that are going to inform the next big shift in this world? Like, what's going to make for the next major change for how we view this topic?
In the first place, I think interfaith has become very much a local phenomenon in the United States, at least. And I think increasingly will in other parts of the world as well, but in all different ways, because the interfaith movement, you might say, is like whatever a movement is. It's like a peace movement or something like that. It has many different shapes and many different mm-hmm. forms. It has no single leadership. It doesn't have a command center. It is just a movement of people toward one another. And we started work a few years ago with some support from Arthur Vining Davis on the what we call the interfaith infrastructure, looking mm-hmm. at a number of American cities. We started with 20, but really there are many, many, to see what kind of interfaith initiatives are taking place. And they are so many, and there is a little sort of patch on our website that's called the interfaith infrastructure. But it really begins to ask questions and tell stories and document the different kinds of interfaith movements. There are things that we all know well as educators and as young people, like the Interfaith Youth Corps that now has traction in so many places in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Eboo Patel and his great band of volunteers and people who are part of that movement undertake. But there also are interfaith women's movements, women's initiatives, like the Women Transcending Boundaries up in Syracuse, New York. There are lots of kind of getting to know you initiatives, like the Amazing Faith Dinner Dialogues that started in Houston and now have spread to other places. And there are some that are more civically oriented toward doing things together, building a Habitat for Humanity's house. So I think that the number of kinds of initiatives, organizations, is really great and very, very diverse. So, and I think you must see this, certainly, at NYU
for
and
sure.
the kinds of things that you have students engaged in there. So it's not just the old pattern of a few people meeting around a table. I mean, the tables, so to speak, with quotes around it, The tables are many, and they are our universities and colleges. There are dorms and, and living quarters. They are neighborhoods. They're city councils. They're the legal mechanisms in the United States that are some of the ways in which people encounter one another in the courtroom. But there are lots of ways in which that encounter takes place these days.
Great. Molly?
Yeah, so I agree. Interfaith work today takes shape in so many different styles and mechanisms. But for me, something I've been questioning recently is whether there's value in interfaith dialogue in the absence of tangible activities like community organizing or service work.
I think there is. I mean, I really believe in community organizing and service work, and I think it is an important way for people to come together. But I also believe that the project of understanding, it's one I deeply believe in as an educator, something that happens in the university is much wider than that, and that may begin the process of a sort of personal transformation or intellectual transformation that leads to the kind of work that you're describing. I'll give you an example. Here at Harvard, there's a very active Hindu student organization called Dharma, and they basically bring Hindu students together in their prayer space to have discussions every Friday afternoon, different topics. They have a Diwali celebration that's open to their whole college, and they come and they cook and they bring their roommates, and it is a, you know, just a wonderful and huge affair in which they, I know this personally because they use the master's residence where I live at Lowell House as their primary location, because I have a living room and parlor and dining room that are sort of larger than most. And so they sort of move all the furniture and set up the altar in the fireplace and have a Diwali puja and sing and tell stories. That also is really valuable. Valuable for them as they think about who they are as Hindus in America, and valuable for their roommates who come. Last Friday, I was away, unfortunately, but I have been here before, that group had a college-wide dance, a hungama, in which they do Ras dance and stick dances and the whole range of wonderful South Indian dance moves, you know? So dance begins here about 10 o'clock at night, or maybe 10:30. Before the dance, these students set up a altar in the middle of our dining hall, and they've got the dining hall all decorated. They have an altar, and they do a puja. This is usually during Navaratri, so they do that. The Harvard Islamic Society also has these sorts of things, where they might have a iftar at the end of a day of fast in Ramadan. In fact, they have iftars every night that are open to students and their roommates and their friends, and they have one for faculty and they have one for staff. But these are things that are not like dialogues. They're not even talking dialogues. But what they are opportunities to encounter one another's cultures, things that mean something to us in ways that are quite transformative. And I think all of that will lead to a new generation of interfaith leadership, multi-faith leadership. And I think you've got a great thing going at NYU, that you have multi-faith leadership seminars and that sort of thing, because this is the kind of leadership that we need. People who have some understanding of who we all are in some ways, and what are the things that matter to us. But I do think that that there are many ways in which that can happen. It can happen in dance, it can happen in meditation, it can happen in festivals and holidays as well.
So I'm curious, you've been talking a lot about Hinduism especially, and I know that for many of our students, for many Americans, they're very, obviously very familiar with Christianity and pretty familiar with Judaism. And then I think probably in the last 15, 20 years have grown increasingly familiar with Buddhism, Hinduism, and Islam. And I'm curious if there are other religions that you have spent time studying or spent time chronicling their communities in the United States that kind of most people on college campuses or just most Americans more broadly are less aware of that you think it's it would be important for us to learn more about. And you think like they're the kind of the next groups that people are going to start to come into contact with more often and it's important for us to be aware of.
Well, there are quite a few, really. I mean, you probably would have mentioned the Sikhs. And Sikhs, of course, are not a large group in the U.S., but very visible because of turbans, because of the head coverings, and also because they have been slightly more litigious, you might say, in presenting their case to the National Transportation Safety Board and other places to say, listen, you need to know who we are. We wear these turbans for particular reasons, etc. And so if you, you know, if you want to search us, you need to have the sensitivities that that would involve. Sikhs are not are relatively not known, and when I teach my case studies class on religious encounter in the U.S., there are a couple of times where the Sikh cases are presented, and for many students, and these are, you know, intelligent college students, it's the first time they've really learned anything about the Sikhs. Another, of course, are the Wiccans, and the many sort of neo-pagan, but I think Wiccan is a good enough term to begin with, because they also are sort of out there at the edges of people's interfaith understanding. And there are quite a few Wiccans in the U.S. that some people would see them as sort of the avant-garde of the environmental movement. And as this season of Halloween, et cetera, rolls around, knowledge about what Wiccan sisters and brothers do is something that most people don't have. They think of it as kind of a cult or something. Then there are humanists who are increasingly organized. And there are atheists. Who also actually want to be involved in interfaith things. And
I mean, that
comes as a surprise. If they're atheists, why do they care about interfaith? But, you know, these are, and certainly Native people. I come from Montana, and the Native people are still, after all these years, among the least understood American communities.
For sure, for sure. It's also really interesting you're kind of looping in the humanists and the atheists here because we have an amazing humanist chaplain at NYU and also one of the people I facilitate like religious literacy workshops with is she calls herself a non-theist but is very involved in interfaith work and religious diversity and is one of the best at doing these kind of workshops. So she's always a fun person to have in the room because I think she challenges some stereotypes that our participants might have.
It's true. And, you know, I mean, I like having them also because when you speak about theism or atheism, one of the things that's always a curiosity for me is what kind of God don't you believe in? what does theism mean to you that you would, you know, then move away from it? Because I teach, you know, in my course on Hindu worlds of art and culture, this term of multiple theisms, and it is true that people who are not theistic also have a particular view of theism, and that becomes something very interesting for people who are God believers in one way or another. I would say one of the other things that you mentioned, Christian Jewish dialogue, etc., but one of the other things that I think is not too well done in many places, and I say this as someone who has been watching these things at Harvard for some years, and that is Christian-Jewish-Muslim dialogue. I mean, there is this kind of sense that Abrahamic dialogue, well, it does have a lot of positive and very wonderful things going in the U.S. I mean, we've just gone through this, or maybe in the middle of this twinning weekend or weeks in which synagogues and Islamic centers all over the country twin with one another and pair and exchange visits and congregational workshops and that sort of thing. But on the whole, there's a lot of Christian, Jewish, Muslim dialogue that gets stifled in a way because of the wariness of treading on the sensitive issues in the Middle East. Mm. And a lot of people, students and others, don't feel that they are qualified to say much about this, or that they really are qualified and very passionate about it. And as a result, those conversations are tough. We did do one last week that was on challenging issues in Christian, Jewish, Muslim dialogue that was pretty well attended. It was launched by Harvard Hillel, not held in the Hillel space, but in the Center for Government and International Studies. And that was basically involved three professors leading the way. That was a professor of Jewish studies and me as a Christian, a professor of Islamic studies. But that got very quickly into the way in which these issues can become frightening, stifling, and then also extremely heated, so that you can't really talk at all. And I think all of us recognize the ways in which that's the case, and the ways in which that sort of facilitated dialogue that you've had at NYU is very, very important.
I agree. Changing the topic slightly, as we all know, this past year was marked by several incidences of religious intolerance, with the Chapel Hill Muslim shooting and the Charleston church massacre, leaving many faith communities grieving and experiencing vulnerability. Do you think that these events have changed our perspective of religious coexistence in America?
I think so. I think at every point they do, and because these are so widely publicized and known across the country, and the community response to them and the interfaith response to them known both locally and nationally, I think it does raise people's consciousness that that hate crimes, whether racially or religiously based, are not a thing of the past in the U.S. Now, the Pluralism Project throughout the 1990s, like 10 years before 9/11, also documented over the sort of laboriously, really, over the weeks and months, the ways in which these incidents have happened continually. I mean, from the Dotbuster murders in New Jersey in the 1990s to the spate of violence that took place after the Oklahoma City bombing that was mistakenly thought to be Muslim for a few hours only, but that.
Well, we're in New York City here, so we are familiar with this very, very much.
You know how this stuff happens.
Absolutely.
And you know, there was, I mean, before there was the internet, and a lot of people don't really think before there was the internet, but you know, the Netscape came into view about 1994. You actually had to look for this stuff,
and
so that the groups like the Anti-Defamation League, for example, and its counterpart, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the work that they did with their own communities was extremely valuable.
Right.
Now I think the public knowledge of what happens is really transformative, and does provide the, you know, the sort of opening for people who are not in that community to talk about it. And I think to have prompts and even some educational materials that make that possible, that are widely distributed, is a very, very helpful thing, because people do want to talk and they do care.
Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly what I've found. We only have a few more minutes left, so I'm curious, switching gears a little bit, but I know that you live in housing on campus, and you spend a lot of time, obviously, with students and not only doing your research. So for people who maybe don't know much about what that entails, could you tell us a little bit about that and why you're interested in it and why you dedicate so much time to it?
Yes, spouse Dorothy and I are housemasters of one of the 12 Harvard residential communities or houses, Lowell House. And what's different from New York is just about everyone lives in one of these houses as undergraduates.
Right.
And we have graduate student tutors who live here as well and faculty who are affiliated with each of the houses. So they are kind of microcosmic communities within Harvard University. And that means that the diversity that is part of the university is also part of our day-to-day community. That means that we have social events and roundtable discussions that include lots of things, like the Hungama dance that took place on Friday night, but also like the race and diversity tables that take place every Thursday night, where there'll be some sort of prompt to talk about particular issues. And you know, whoever wants to do that around the dining hall will join in. So I do this because I actually like having a living relationship with students that is not simply in the classroom, though I teach into these issues in the classroom as well, but that is enlivened by the lunch and dinner table conversations and the issues that come up in the house. And so you could say it's sort of like living in the lab of the future America, because these are students who will be leaders in one way or another, low-key or high visibility. And for them to have some sort of multi-religious awareness that is not simply casual, but that is more deliberate, is quite important.
Yeah, it's so something...
I guess you could say I'm a teacher who is always learning from my students, and this is one of the places that I learn.
Right. That's great. It's really interesting. I'm also curious, and this, I wish I had asked about this a little sooner, but I know that most, and I'm sure Molly can speak to this as well, but most interfaith or multi-faith spaces tend to actually be dominated by men. And I'd imagine people who don't identify as LGBT. So I'm curious how you, as someone who holds both of those identities, has found space, or has there been pushback, or has it really been easy to kind of speak out and be as vocal on these issues as you have been?
Yeah, I mean, I would say you're right. If you look at, you know, big international conferences and that sort of thing, I've done quite a bit of that and have sort of pulled back a bit. But it, yes, that's dominated largely by men who have very colorful costumes, and it makes for a really good photo op. But I think the issue of LGBT issues in relation to interfaith is becoming, it's becoming much more something that is discussable.
Yeah.
You know, there's a way in which I don't sort of deploy my gay identity all the time, because
right.
it is so well known mm-hmm. at Harvard and elsewhere. But the fact that students who struggle with these things in relation to their hometown Christian communities or their Muslim or Hindu communities, that they struggle with these things and they know there's a space to talk about it. So we do have LGBT tutors who are designated in the house to facilitate that kind of discussion.
Yeah.
And I would also say that these issues are issues that are on the cusp of awareness
mm-hmm.
in virtually every community. I mean,
yeah.
I have Hindu colleagues, Muslim colleagues, certainly Christian Jewish colleagues who are all very much engaged in LGBT issues as professors, as you know, older people who feel that, you know, that they have gone through a few struggles themselves and would like to have space where younger people can find this to be safe and a discussable issue.
Yeah, one of the best programs I think we run is actually a lecture series, dialogue series called Queering Faith, which is discussing the intersections of queer identity and multi-faith and focusing on different religions. It's always really interesting, I think, and super important and under-talked about topic among religious people.
It really is. says, I may steal that title. It sounds good.
I don't think we have it trademarked, so I think it may be fair game.
Okay. I think what one sometimes finds is that there are students who are in the process of thinking about and coming out in gender identity, mm-hmm. Who are really alienated from their religious communities.
Yeah.
So, they're not sure about faith at all. I think that kind of forum sounds really wonderful.
Yeah, and I'm sure you feel this way also, but one of the best parts of working at a university is that I have colleagues at the LGBTQ Student Center who I work with all the time, and it's not, I never have to search for those resources. They're just down the hall.
Yes, that's great. That's great. We don't have a center of kind of office building like you do at NYU. I'm not sure exactly what your geography looks like, but we have quite a few groups that meet everywhere. I mean, the Harvard Buddhist community, the Dharma community, the Harvard Islamic Society, Hillel, and a whole spate of Christian groups, Asian American Christian Fellowship, and the other array of Christian fellowships as well.
Great.
It is a very interesting place to be involved in multi-faith affairs. And I think the kind of initiatives that NYU has undertaken are really exciting, and I think a lot of us could learn from them. So I'm glad you're doing what you're doing.
Well, for the record, to anyone listening, we did not ask her to give us a plug at the end of the interview. That was all on you.
Great. Thank you. For this chance.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining us. We really, really appreciate it and love getting the chance to talk to you anytime we can. Thank you for listening to another episode of Multifaithful. We'd especially like to thank our guest, Dr. Diana Eck, for joining us and dedicating her time this morning. Thank you, as always, to Brian Young for his efforts in producing, editing, and doing all things related to this podcast. Thank you to Molly, one of our amazing student leaders here on campus in many, many capacities, for joining me in this interview. Thank you to Liz Suatos, whose music is originally from the Of Many film. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or any thoughts about the podcast you'd like to reach out, please send us an email at spiritual.life@nyu.edu. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We'd love to get a 5-star rating. It makes my mother very proud of me. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. We'll see you in future weeks.